India is going to become an element in Israel's national security. We are getting a huge amount of attention from the Israeli leadership at all levels. And the challenge for me is to actually untap that potential. And this is what we are doing on a day-to-day basis in the work of our embassy in Delhi.
Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute Senior Fellow and Senior Political Correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, your co-host and Executive Director of the Misgav Institute. The Misgav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center focused on strengthening Israel's national security, regional cooperation, and international alliances. Each week here on the Misgav Mideast Horizons podcast, we'll cut through the noise and the slogans to bring you fresh insights, not only on the most urgent and critical issues on the national security and Middle East agenda, but also on the exciting trends and opportunities that are taking shape in this incredible region.
Please subscribe to the podcast and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. We're on all the major platforms and we're on YouTube. And of course, you can reach out to us with comments, suggestions, and sponsorship opportunities at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
This week, we have another amazing and very timely guest, Israel's Ambassador Reuven Azar, Israel's Ambassador to India. Ambassador Azar, before serving as ambassador to India, served as the foreign policy advisor to Prime Minister Netanyahu and was quite involved in the Abraham Accords in that capacity. Before that, he served as a deputy ambassador in Washington, D.C. Before that, he served in Israel's embassies in Egypt, in Jordan, spent time working on the Middle East economic issues. Somebody who's certainly given the meeting that took place just yesterday between Prime Minister Netanyahu and United States President Trump has a very relevant and important insight into what is going on and what it might mean for the Middle East.
So let's talk about the Trump-Netanyahu meeting. From what I understand from my sources in Washington, I'm also covering this as a reporter, the big topics were Gaza ceasefire talks and Iran. Syria was also one of the topics. Trump would like there to be a peace agreement between Israel and Syria, but the indications and what I'm hearing is that's still pretty far from happening.
Sure. And certainly the question of Gaza ceasefire, of a hostage deal has been the focus of discussions in Israel, and for obvious reasons, we still have 50 hostages in Gaza that we all want to see brought home. I think, though, that when obviously, you know, we know that hostage families have met with President Trump, that he's committed to this issue on a personal level, and I think we said an emotional level. We saw the meetings between him and hostage families. But I do think that when President Trump, and to also Prime Minister Netanyahu, when they look at this moment, and even when they look at Gaza, they're looking at this broader picture of a new order in the Middle East, a new order where Iran is weakened, where Israel and Saudi Arabia and other countries in the Middle East are able to expand their relations, normalize their relations in order for these new economic corridors to come to shape, which align with U.S. interests and with the U.S. competition with other global powers. But for all that to happen, one, certainly for the normalization component to happen, is critical that we have a de-escalation in Gaza. And I think that for President Trump, that's a key goal in terms of what he's looking to get in vis-a-vis the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, so I think there's sort of an interesting dichotomy where the public discourse in Israel and what President Trump is saying are very similar, actually, where they're both like saying, let's end the war, let's get all the hostages out. But when you talk to officials behind the scene, especially Israeli officials, they say that it's just not that simple. And the reason that the negotiations in Doha in Qatar this week were about a temporary ceasefire, a 60-day ceasefire, and not the end of the war, is that Hamas is just not willing to surrender yet. And Israel is not going to end the war until Hamas does not control Gaza, until, you know, what Netanyahu has called total victory, right? And my understanding from a senior official in Netanyahu's delegation is that Hamas is not willing to put down its arms. The few leaders that remain at this point in the war are not willing to go into exile. And that Israel says without that, you know, Hamas can do October 7th again. So Israel's not going to end the war. That I found that statement interesting in contrast with a BBC report from a couple of days ago, where they quoted an anonymous senior officer in Hamas security forces that says Hamas has lost control over 80% of the Gaza Strip, and that 95% of the leaders are dead. So the war might be able to end sooner if Hamas were to agree to a full ceasefire and end of war right now, but we might reach the end of the war through other means if this Hamas official's assessment is true.
I think from most of what I've been hearing from the American side is that both President Trump and then also from the Israeli side, Prime Minister Netanyahu, are both committed to this goal of a Gaza Strip, which Hamas does not control. And the important point here, and this is something that needs to be made clear, is that it's not just formal control, who, you know, is called a minister and sits in an office, but who has control de facto. If there's going to be a rebuilding of a hospital and there's going to be cement or heavy construction materials coming in, who ultimately is going to control? And I think that the BBC report was a little bit surprising, because I think while it's true, Hamas has fired a few rockets, but does not currently have the ability to carry out a massive attack against Israel, I believe that it still controls significantly more of the Gaza Strip in practice, except for potentially some areas in the south that Israel now controls or that are more Hamas-free and controlled by other local actors. In most of the Gaza Strip, Hamas still, let's recall, has potentially tens of thousands of armed fighters, hundreds of kilometers of terror tunnels. Certainly once Israel pulls out, they will reemerge and still have the ability to anybody who opposes their rule to intimidate them, to harm them, to threaten them and their families.
Well, then they also have the ability to inflict serious casualties. I mean, there are several Israeli soldiers were killed this week in Gaza, unfortunately.
I agree. And we should, today was to the news this morning, we're recording on July 8th, was very tragic with five Israeli soldiers losing their lives in the northern Gaza Strip.
And I believe that there was a trap laid for them in a tunnel. So it sort of goes to your point.
Right. Or explosives at IEDs that went off as they were on a patrol. And that is leading Israel to question, how much longer should we continue the Gaza war? And you can certainly understand that feeling. On the other hand, we should ask the question of what happens if Hamas reestablishes control over Gaza. Are we going to find ourselves in another devastating war in a short period of time? But Lav, I wanted to ask you, the issue of the President Trump's vision of voluntary emigration for Gazans from Gaza came up again in the meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu. What do you make of that?
Well, it's interesting because in front of the cameras, President Trump said, you should ask Netanyahu. And Netanyahu said sort of what he's been saying, which is that if people want to leave, they should be allowed to leave. Behind the scenes, the senior official on the trip was saying that it was a topic of discussion between Netanyahu and Trump in their meeting. And that the Israelis think that Trump is serious about it, but that they, the sort of American and Israeli teams, need to work together in a more serious way to actually figure out technically what they're going to do. And that I'm making this assumption based on what they said, but I think that up until now, it had not been so serious. You might have heard, just as I had heard from different people, that there was a little bit of outreach done to some countries who might accept refugees, but there wasn't concentrated push. And so I'm not saying there's going to be, but it sounds like they're talking more seriously, because it's not just opening the gates and letting people out, right? They have to have somewhere to go. And so it is an undertaking. You can't just open the gates.
It's true. And it goes back to the interconnectedness between all the various issues. One interesting idea that I've heard lately is that given the likelihood of vast investment in reconstructing Syria and Syria's desire to, first of all, have the sanctions be removed, which seems to be on the way towards doing that, and the United States and President Trump made an announcement regarding that, and then drawing in vast amounts of investment, whether from the West or from the Gulf, that for the 50% of Gazans, which have said in Palestinian opinion polls that they would emigrate if given the chance, that might be a potential solution, assuming that Syria is put on the path of stability and economic growth. There are already quite a large number of the descendants of Palestinian refugees in Syria, and Syria could potentially be a destination for Gazans who are looking to emigrate from the territory.
My sort of like reality check with this whole emigration thing, because it sounds like a great plan in theory, is when you look at those polls, they want to move to Europe and Canada. And Europe and Canada, I mean, maybe a few tens of thousands could go to Europe and Canada, but they're not accepting that many of them, right? And then you have to say, are they going to voluntarily leave to go to Syria? Or are they going to voluntarily leave to go into Somaliland, which is another one of these reports where I don't know that conditions in Somaliland are much better than Gaza at war. And so that's always my like word of caution about this, which is that I don't know how many will voluntarily emigrate if the options are not such great options.
Last week on our podcast, we had Reverend Dr. Johnny Moore, the chair of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, and he spoke to us at length about the threats that he and his team, who are distributing millions of meals in the Gaza Strip, are receiving from Hamas and the UN and other international bodies, are taking part in the campaign of demonization against the organization. And then just a few days later, somebody in the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and other sources say that it was Hamas attacked his team who was distributing food, injuring two Americans. It looks like, unfortunately, his words of warning and caution came true.
Yeah, I mean, I think the writing was on the wall, right? That something like that was going to happen. It's pretty terrible. In the meantime, though, there was something else that I think that Johnny Moore drew attention to in the interview that maybe people didn't think as much about, but also came up in the headlines this week, which is that they don't cover northern Gaza, right? They only cover southern Gaza. And in northern Gaza, he was very concerned about who's getting the food there. And Israel has allowed an increase in the number of trucks that can go into northern Gaza because more humanitarian aid is needed. That's sort of new in the last few days. Even though the cabinet knows that essentially Hamas takes over all the aid going into northern Gaza. So you would need an expansion of GHF operations, but it would also require enough IDF troops to secure the GHF operations. And so it's a complicated situation. I was listening, some of the questions that I know Israeli reporters have been asking Netanyahu's team on this trip are, well, if the GHF is supposed to take care of the problem of Hamas taking over, then why is it taking so long? But it's, everything sounds simpler in theory, right? And northern Gaza is like, right now the army's focused on southern Gaza. You can't, the sort of confluence of events of this unfortunate attack, this tragic attack on aid workers, and more trucks going into the north just show how much the work is not finished in Gaza, you know, how much work there is still left to do.
And the focus is understandably on Gaza, but I remain concerned that there's very relatively little focus on Judea and Samaria, on the West Bank. We know that PA President Abbas is in the 20th year of his four-year term, will at some point no longer be in power. And the question is then, what comes next? And this week, there was a very interesting story regarding local clan leaders, local sheikhs from Hebron, who announced that they wanted to essentially work directly with Israel. They would recognize Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, and Israel would recognize them as the legitimate leaders of Hebron. And they would, in fact, join the Abraham Accords. Now, this is actually an initiative that has been underway for quite some time, and it really challenges the status quo, the what everybody knows, right? Since Oslo, since 1994, the status quo has been the PA, a centralized authority. We're going to negotiate a political settlement with the PA, and that's going to lead to a two-state solution. That, for one reason or another, you can have an argument about why, has not happened since Oslo. And now you have a new paradigm of, okay, let's find other local leaders. And it seems to me that that may be a process that will only grow stronger as Abu Mazen, as Abbas's rule comes to an end, and as more and more actors, some very hostile to Israel and some more focused on constructive cooperation, come to power in various locations around the Palestinian Authority.
So I'm going to be the reality check again. There's been a lot of attention to this story. It was in the Wall Street Journal, and Jerusalem Post worked sort of together on it. And I don't disagree. Like, there needs to be some sort of new paradigm, and it would be really nice if this was it, maybe. And I also think that if there are elements in Palestinian society and politics who want to be friendlier to Israel, Israel should welcome them with open arms. That being said, experts in Palestinian society who I've spoken to, including ones who are critical of a two-state solution of the Oslo Accords and themselves would like to see a different paradigm, are skeptical or basically say that the sheikhs involved are not representative of that many people, even within their own like clans, right? Because each is supposed to represent a clan of thousands of people. You have people who are affiliated with Fatah, which is the Palestinian Authority, basically, or who are affiliated with Hamas. So just because they're the sheikh of a certain clan doesn't mean that this automatically means, I don't know what, 20,000 Palestinians are willing to break off from the Palestinian Authority. So we have to be aware that this isn't like all of a sudden a new peace plan has broken out. All of a sudden Hebron is joining the Abraham Accords, which was one of the things that they suggested. So I wouldn't like dismiss this outright in the sense that I think Israel's arms should be open to these people, but we also shouldn't like rely on it that this is going to be the new thing now.
Well, speaking about the Abraham Accords and the potential for expanding it and the role of Trump and Netanyahu's meeting in that, we have today a fascinating and very timely guest, Israel's ambassador, Reuven Azar, Israel's ambassador to India. Before taking up the role of ambassador to India in 2024, he served as ambassador to Romania. Before that, he served as head of the U.S.-Israel-China Task Force in the Foreign Ministry. Prior to that, he served for a number of years as Prime Minister Netanyahu's foreign policy advisor, working closely with the prime minister on the most critical issues facing Israel's diplomacy. Before that role, he was Israel's deputy ambassador in Washington, D.C. In the past, he's also served in Israel's embassies in Jordan, in Egypt, and focused on critical issues related to Israel's role in the Middle East. So I think this is a fantastic time. We have a fantastic conversation. We're going to go deep, go beyond the headlines, and go down deep into what's really happening in the Middle East, what is the role of India, and especially what is the role of economics, investment, technology, infrastructure? How are all these issues, which sometimes don't get the same headlines, but are really key factors in shaping the future of the Middle East? Ambassador Reuven Azar, it is a great pleasure to have you on our podcast. Welcome. It's been incredible to follow your career and all of your important contributions to regional cooperation to the State of Israel over the years. We know that while the Israeli discourse in Washington has been mostly focused a lot on the hostage deal, ceasefire, the topics that were discussed relate also to the future of regional cooperation, the Abraham Accords, the future of the Middle East. And what a lot of people don't realize is that India is a central player in shaping that vision of the future of the Middle East. So as Israel's ambassador to India, somebody who also worked directly on the Abraham Accords, what can you tell us about India's role in this future of regional normalization and the future of the Middle East?
Well, thank you, Asher. Thank you, Lav, for hosting me. India is a rising power, and it is now about $4 trillion, the size of its economy, and it's about to double that number in a few years. So they're going to become the third biggest economy in a couple of years. And they are now in intensive negotiations with the United States on a trade deal. The idea of a trade deal doesn't necessarily only mean that you're going to have more merchandise flowing from east to west and vice versa, and therefore you need connectivity, and the Middle East is key. But also we're talking here about a technological partnership, about a partnership that is going to allow both India and the U.S. to have the competitive advantage they need in world markets in a world that is coming very competitive. Okay, so for us it's a huge opportunity because Israel is the biggest innovation hub outside the United States. India is interested in that innovation, and because of the geographic location of Israel and its neighbors, so India has been working in the last few years to establish a series of deals with the eastern part of IMEC, the India Middle East Economic Corridor. And these agreements are agreements to connect customs, to connect the ports, and they are creating a digital platform that would facilitate the flow of goods. Now, the plan is basically to have that IMA corridor expanded westward to the west. And that would include countries like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Israel. As you know, in Haifa, there is an Indian port owned by a company called Adani. And there are other ports that are also working on that corridor. Actually, that corridor started more than a decade ago when the civil war in Syria started. And at that point, it was essential to get merchandise from Haifa to the Jordanian market and vice versa. But here we are talking about something that it's much more substantial, because we are talking about an opportunity to create a corridor that not only would include merchandise, but can include many other elements of connectivity. For example, energy projects. Other example would be, logistical centers.
So I want to understand. I mean, I know over the years there's been talk about sort of rail connections, but also like fiber optic internet or other sort of energy projects. But where do things actually stand? I assume that the war in Gaza and all of the other fronts has slowed things down a lot. So can you give us like an idea of where we are right now and what you think could happen in the, say, short to medium term?
So it's happening right now is a preliminary kind of stage in which you have think tanks that are, writing feasibility studies, like, for example, the Center for Maritime Strategies in Haifa, other think tanks in India. And they are connected already with think tanks in Saudi Arabia, in Jordan, in UAE, etc. So these guys are discussing options, possibilities, and doing research. Governments have been starting to engage. You're right that as long as we have the continuation of the conflict, it's going to be hard for countries like Jordan and Saudi to come officially to start dealing with that. But we know that they have an interest in that. And we know that there are private sector actors that have an interest in that. So the current situation is that we are having a flow of goods with trucks. Usually they come to the UAE and then the trucks go to Jordan. There they change papers and then some of the merchandise comes through the Beit Shean crossing and goes to Haifa. This is not a big volume. At this point, we're talking about, a couple hundred of trucks per day. But the potential of that increasing is huge, because I'll give you just one example. When you want to send merchandise from India to Europe, for example, the cheapest way to do it is via vessels. But that takes about 50 days. If you want to create a situation in which you don't have to create huge stocks because of that supply line that is very long, you can establish, for example, a backlog in Jordan, and then you need 1 week only to ship from Jordan to any port or any market in Europe. So it can be a kind of a shortcut, especially that would serve not only companies that are in need for speedy supplies, but also to be a kind of a center in which you can get merchandise stored for relatively cheap price. In Israel, for example, it's very expensive to do storage. Just on the logistics, this is very, very, can be very, very profitable. So we are dragging interest from companies. Two companies that have absolute interest to work on that are, of course, the ports in Haifa that want to work. So we are connecting the ports in Haifa with, interest parties along those countries.
It sounds like when President Trump and potentially also Prime Minister Netanyahu are looking at this moment in the Middle East, and again, the question of a ceasefire in Gaza and the war, hostage deal are critical questions that are affecting certainly all Israelis, and obviously the 50 hostages are still being held there. But they're looking more broadly at this almost reorganization of the Middle East and of global trade patterns, global patterns of resilience and supply chains. I think obviously the competition also with China comes into a role here, because if you draw India closer to Europe and ultimately the United States via this new land corridor, you also provide an ability to get pharmaceuticals or textiles or electronics from India as opposed to from China. When India looks at the Middle East, looks at Israel, what do they see? Because it does seem that they also have economic interests vis-a-vis Iran, for example. So how do they see, when Netanyahu and Trump meeting in the White House, what are the Indians looking for and hoping for?
Well, the first thing, as I told you, is technology. The Indian market is growing very fast. And sometimes there are gaps and technological solutions that are needed in order to scale up. Take, for example, the Indian car industry. Okay, it has been so far supplying mainly the Indian market. But if they want to compete in markets around the world, maybe they should consider working with a company like Mobileye that is already working with the Japanese car industry, with the German car industry. So this is one example, and that's mobility. But there are many other examples that have to do with communications, with cyber, with health sciences, with agriculture. The Indians have been looking at Israel for solutions in agriculture, and we have established Indo-Israeli centers of excellence. There are now 32 of them that are working in India and making a huge impact on food security in India. India is interested in the region because, as I told you, it can be, it is not only the markets in the region itself for fields, for example, like guest workers. India wants to export 100 million workers, okay? And they have millions of workers already working in the Gulf, and increasingly now in Israel, we have 40,000 of them, and we're going to increase them. In addition to that, as I mentioned before, the whole logistic issue. You can always, you know, lean on maritime transport, but there are complementary solutions like the IMEC that can give you additional value, both in terms of speed and also in terms of getting your merchandise closer to the customer. So these are three fields that are, I think, that are very important for India.
So I want to ask you, the BRICS countries just condemned the Israeli strikes on Iran. What has the impact of the war in Gaza and now the strikes on Iran had on sort of Indian public opinion towards Israel? And then also, India, it seems to me, is like an awkward fit in BRICS, right? For many, many decades, India was like a non-aligned country. But in more recently, and especially under Modi, they're a lot more pro-Western and pro-American, it seems, even though they sort of maintain their sort of uniqueness, I would say, on the world stage. So I guess if you could answer to those two things. Number one, how has the strikes in Iran and the war in Gaza impacted their view on Israel? And number two, what do you think about this, like their continued sort of partnership with BRICS, them being part of this statement from countries that feel very differently about Israel than India usually does?
Well, generally speaking, India's public opinion has been very supportive of Israel. I feel it in my interviews. I feel it in my social media engagement. The majority of the people has a sense that we are actually facing the same challenge, the challenge of radicalism and terrorism. And, you know, I'll give you an example. I've been doing in the last month following our preemptive attack to remove these existential threats from Iran. I did about 40 interviews. Most of the interviews, people, you know, showed a lot of sympathy towards Israel. There were some challenging interviews. Of course, you know, the situation in Gaza is not comfortable for anybody, including us. Human suffering there is quite visible, and people expect to, you know, to get explanations of why this is happening and why, you know, it's taking so long. But they are receptive to our messages. You know, there are places in which people are not receptive. In India, people are receptive. And so we've been seeing this very positive attitude. There are, of course, those who are criticizing, especially, you know, people from in the south, from opposition parties, parties that are more in line, you know, in line with more radical elements, etc. They are more critical, but we are managing to get to all these audiences and. You know, put forward our position, and I think we're getting to hundreds of millions of people. That's great. Now, on the multilateral sphere, I think that now, on top of that, of course, there is the attitude of the government. India and the Prime Minister of India has been supporting Israel's right to self-defense following the 7th of October. And generally speaking, when it comes to international fora, they have been at least abstaining most of the time. So although you are right, and the BRICS, they joined a declaration condemning us, I think what they got in return is a condemnation of the Pahalgam terrorist attack. So I think it was a sort of give and take kind of compromise they had to do. But generally speaking, they've been continuing with us our defense cooperation. We enjoy huge amounts of trust as a result of 30 years of very good cooperation between our defense establishment, and we are helping each other to, you know, to basically construct, to produce the solutions we need to increase our capabilities when it comes to dealing with those threats. So, yes, India, first of all, takes care of India, okay? And they have been, you know, frustrated from the way in which they were treated, for example, in the United Nations, the fact that they don't have a seat in the Security Council. And they have been looking for alternative bodies to get their voice in a more effective way. The main body that have been they've been investing in is actually not BRICS, but the G20. There they seem to have more flexibility to serve their interest in shaping the rules of the game. And here we get to something that is pretty interesting, because sometimes this interest to become a world power does not necessarily go in line with the agenda of the Global South. And there's sometimes kind of a dichotomy. But at the end of the day, it represents a natural dichotomy.
Ambassador Azad, you were previously, in a previous role, you were ambassador to Romania, but before that you were foreign policy advisor to the Prime Minister, to Prime Minister Netanyahu, and you served as deputy ambassador in Washington. Can you take us a little bit, I think our listeners would be very interesting to hear sort of behind the scenes, what it's like to prepare for a meeting in the White House with President Trump?
Well, that's interesting. Look, there are different circles of work. There's the highest level, which is the personal level between a prime minister and a president. And then there is the professional circle around them. Usually the professional circles maintain contact on a day-to-day basis, and they are the one that prepare the main deliverables in such meetings. Naturally, when you have a relationship that is so wide and so deep between two countries, there are issues that are being sorted out, you know, on a day-to-day basis, but there are some issues that are left for the leaders to decide because they are too crucial or because there are some gap that you have to narrow. And therefore, usually before a visit like that, you crystallize from the system those issues that are more critical. For example, if there is an issue on defense procurement that needs to be sorted out, or there is an economic agreement has to be signed. Right now, for example, we are having these negotiations on a trade deal. Israel is usually, you know, the guinea pig when the United States has a new policy. So the expectation is that the first to sort of cooperate with the initiative, it would be Israel, because then that sets an example for the rest of the countries on how to treat an American initiative. So that creates sometimes pressures to expedite things at the leader level in order to give the sense that this relationship is going to the next level.
One of the big issues on this trip is Iran. We've already discussed Iran a bit, but both President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu said they want to preserve the achievements of the operation in Iran, right? They want to make sure the nuclear program stays rolled back, the ballistic missile program stays rolled back. I know you have a lot of experience on this front in the National Security Council, and you were on the sanctions team. What do you think Israel is sort of trying to do on this front? Like, how can we preserve the achievements diplomatically?
If I could just add to the question, do you think there may be a gap specifically related to the ballistic missile issue?
Right, because sources on the delegation said last night that the U.S. and Israel are in sync, but I know that before that, that's been sort of one of the concerns, one of the things where they seem to have a different message.
Well, look, I'm afraid to disappoint you because this is not my turf and not my responsibility. I'm not dealing with this on the day-to-day basis. The only thing that I can tell you out of my experience of dealing with these issues is that there are several things that, you know, you have to sort out because there, as I said, there are different circles. There's a circle that you know, the leaders themselves that might have an aim and you have to verify whether those aims, you know, are coordinated. And then you have the bureaucracy under that. And when it comes to the professional level, the bureaucracy, there are always nuances that can become very important because the immediate concerns of the parties can, although we have the same interest, can differ a bit. Take, for example, the geographical situation, okay? So there is a situation in which there are American assets in the region, there are Israeli assets. We, thanks to the Abraham Accords, have upgraded the capability to coordinate those interests at the military level and the bureaucratic level, thanks to the fact that Israel was moved from UCOM to CENTCOM. So the fact that you had during the last 20 months many visits of General Kurila, for example, to Israel, that gives you a sense that there is much more coordination at that level, and that actually it's the potential for getting agreement and coordination and to really being in sync on all levels is much higher now than it used to be in the past. And that gives me a lot of optimism without, you know, getting into the details, because I'm not into the details, that these things can be sorted out and we can continue to be in sync like we've been so far. And I think it has been pretty impressive the way that, you know, this entire operation against Iran was conducted, and how narrow, if at all, were the gaps between Israel and the United States while conducting it.
You have interesting experience that very few Israeli diplomats have, which is that you've, at the beginning of your career, you spent time in Gaza working with the Palestinian Authority, authorities there. You also spent a lot of time in the Arab world, in our embassies in Jordan and in Egypt. You speak Arabic. When you look at Gaza back then, sort of at pre-Oslo, pre-Palestinian Authority, or actually just the very beginning of Oslo, beginning of Palestinian Authority rule there, and then you look at the evolution that Gaza has undergone until today, prior to October 7th and post-October 7th, what changes have you seen in Gaza among the Gazi population, among their support for nationalist movements, for Islamist movements? What have you seen?
Well, of course, you know, we've been seeing a situation within the Palestinian constituency that actually is very connected to the events in the larger region. You know, the fact that since 2000, first of all, we had since the 70s, you had a rise in radicalism in the region and the rise of political Islam. So that played a role also within the Palestinian constituency. Then you had the Arab Spring. And following that turmoil, you had collapse of, you know, several Arab states. And you had the civil war inside the Palestinian constituency. And that affected in a tremendous way the prospects of peace between us and the Palestinians. And people have a tendency to forget that. So the fact that Hamas took over the Gaza Strip in 2007, the fact that we, you know, sort of ignored that while we were conducting negotiations with the Palestinians on a peace deal, knowing that it would be almost impossible to implement that if we would have gotten to an agreement in Gaza. But more than that, having negotiations in a situation in which you have a radical force that is existing there and that is actually trying to exterminate not only the state of Israel, but also the other parties within the Palestinian constituency, that created a situation in which the prospects of negotiation and the prospects of getting to a solution were very, very slim as a result of something that happened in the larger region. So at the end of the day, not only that we failed to have a successful negotiation with the Palestinians, despite the fact that we gave very generous offers back in the year 2000 before the second Intifada, our offer was responded by Arafat, by the second Intifada and the terrible campaign of terror. But also when we negotiated again, you know, in Annapolis and during Olbert's time, it was then even the chances of having a solution were even slimmer as a result of the civil war you had. After the Arab Spring, it exploded completely. So I felt it when I was in, and it had negative effects, but it had positive effects, because following the Arab Spring, more and more countries got to the conclusion that actually Israel can be a partner in solving some of the problems. And I was giving you an example of war when you started the conversation, when, you know, the Syria civil war started and the ports in Tartus and Latakia weren't accessible for Jordan. Then they had a huge crisis in their economy. And we were able to ameliorate that through imports of bulk goods through Haifa to the Jordanian market. At that time, we did projects of cooperation, like, for example, the electronic seals project. At the time, there was a textile industry in Jordan that was exporting textiles to the United States under the QIZ legislation. And we, you know, using the very good security coordination with between us and Jordan, we've been able to send this merchandise without security checks. We did during after the crisis, we did also a project called Aurora Trucks that used to come from Europe on ferries and then enter into Jordan, collect goods and go check-free to Europe back. So this fight, so these are economic examples, but of course there are more importantly security examples. The security cooperation between Israel and countries in the region increased substantially as a result of these threats. And of course, the best example was the JCPOA, because we saw the problems, the problematics of the JCPOA, but so did some of our Gulf neighbors, and that also brought us together. So today, I think we are sitting on a platform in which not only you have already, you know, the Abraham Accords and the coordination that is going on under CENTCOM on the security side that permitted and actually made very successful the defense of the airspace of the region against the Iranians. But the prospects of continuing that and expanding that are huge, because they are based on very solid interests, both security interests and economic interests.
You know, you were talking quite a bit about Jordan, and I know that you were posted in Jordan and in Egypt during your career. The peace with those countries is a lot colder, so to speak, than with the UAE. Certainly now during the war, it's not safe for Israelis to visit, but even in more peaceful times, it's a lot less safe than, you know, visiting other places. There's not a lot of people contact, and even the business is not at the same level. Leaving aside the clear economic difference between the UAE and Jordan and Egypt, what prospects do you think there are for warming up that peace or getting closer to our neighbors?
Yeah, well, we have to be realistic about it. You know, things happening in our region, and countries in the region are finding very hard to cope with this rocky wave that we are looking at. So some countries deal with it more successfully. They are taking radicals out of the education system, like in the UAE, like you're beginning to see in Morocco, in Saudi Arabia. Other countries find it more difficult. Now, I wrote a rule after I left Egypt 25 years ago that says something like this: if you want to have a sustainable project that would face the turmoils of the region between Israel and one of its neighbors, it has to be a vital interest of the Arab country, and it has to be a unique advantage that Israel gives. Okay? And I'll give you an example. The first gas deal that we did with Egypt, it was done because Egypt had a vital interest to create, you know, income. Israel was in a unique position because of geography to get the gas, you know, in an immediate way. And there was a way that was found through an international company to have a kind of deniability factor, that if you have a crisis, then it's not the governments that have to deal with it on the day-to-day basis. It's Egypt just selling the gas to an international company, and that international company that owns the gas chooses to sell it to Israel. So until the turmoil, when the Muslim Brotherhood came to power, this actually worked very well and was very beneficial both for Egypt and for Israel. Take the gas deal between Israel and Jordan. So despite the fact that there is a very, you know, powerful element of Muslim Brotherhood, which by the way was banned in Jordan now, and of a Palestinian constituency that is against normalization, Jordan found a way, as a result of the fact that it is the vital interest of their energy, to get Israeli gas, to buy it. We even did an agreement on water, which was an historical agreement, because the water agreement we signed back then, actually, it was the first agreement in the world in which we priced water. Water is usually something that was never priced in international transactions. And we did it with Jordan, okay? It's a world precedent. And that is working, despite all the crisis. So we have to be realistic and work to fulfill the common interest, not to think that because we have an interest, we'll be able to impose it on them, or they will be able to impose on us the terms of a ceasefire, for example, which has to do with our national security. So as long as you are realistic when it comes to understanding the interests of both sides, you can crystallize what is the common interest and find creative ways and sustainable ways of actually creating those projects and make them sustain all the crises that we have seen and we will probably, you know, see in the future.
So apropos crises, and you were involved in the Abraham Accords behind the scenes, including as foreign policy advisor to the prime minister. There were other crises, geopolitical tensions, conflicts before the October 7th and on the same scale. Can you give an example of a time where you felt there was a lot of stress or even a crisis in Abraham Accords relations, but Israel and its partners were able to get through them and maintain the positive momentum, and what they may be able to teach us for restoring the positive momentum today?
Well, I don't remember a crisis in the context of the Abraham Accords, but I can tell you something that, you know, you maybe haven't thought about. Sometimes, because of the central role of Israel is in the economy, you have different interests within a country. Okay, so there were in our relations with Jordan, for example, there were offers done by the Israeli side that we couldn't fulfill because of conflict of interest inside Israel. Take for example the common airport we wanted to build, or the Red Sea Dead Sea pipeline projects that haven't materialized. And sometimes they haven't materialized either because the circumstances have changed in terms of this economy, the feasibility of the projects, or because there were different parties inside the Israeli constituency that weren't coordinated. So what I did, you know, following the Abraham Accords, when we had to deal with promoting all this normalization process, is to make sure that the interagency process in Israel is working well. And that required some negotiations because, you know, people were very enthusiastic at that point and they wanted to lead their initiatives.
Maybe before we can negotiate with the enemies or with peace parties, you have to learn to negotiate with ourselves.
Exactly. Yes. And that is very important because if you don't do that and you work in an uncoordinated way, sometimes you can have one minister can have an initiative and the other ministry will make it fail. So we fortunately created a committee that was formed by the Director General of the Prime Minister's Office, the Director General of the Foreign Ministry, and they coordinated the entire activity for all the ministries in Israel. And that created a kind of an organized process that brought us to sign deals very fast. Sometimes you have conflicting interests. I'll give you another example. Today you have a visa-free agreement with the UAE. You think that was that easy to get into that? Probably you would expect that there would be some security, considerations given the fact that it's an Arab country, right? But we've been able to overcome that. So the coordination within Israel sometimes is crucial to make sure that normalization projects can work. And that is the case with IMEC as well. If we get into a stage in which the negotiations on that will materialize, you will have to have a lot of coordination to see that, you know, things are working smoothly. And today there is a team led by the Director General of the Foreign Ministry, Eden Barkav, that is coordinating the activities of all the ministries in that regard.
So on a different topic, I saw that you were on the Israel-China-US task force. That couldn't have been an easy job. I think the US is often a little frustrated with Israel's approach to China when it comes to infrastructure projects in Israel and tech investments and things like that. And I know now you're in India, which is also very concerned about China. Is there anything you could tell us now about where Israel stands, how its policy might have changed over the years when it comes to Chinese involvement in essential infrastructure and sort of other potentially difficult areas?
Well, again, this is not my responsibility today. So whatever I'll share is some of the experience of dealing with that subject, but without dealing with current issues, okay? This initiative started in 2018 by the American administration. And it was, you know, one of the signs that was very important for the United States is that it was completely bipartisan after the Trump administration was replaced by the Biden administration. The same line continued, okay? So we had a challenge because I think there was a lot of misunderstanding about the nature of Israel's relations with China. And, one of the things, for example, that made it a lot of noise was the port in Haifa, you know, the Chinese port in Haifa. So you happen to speak with a person that actually, you know, handled with that issue personally, because we wanted to avoid an unnecessary crisis with the United States. And I actually checked on that, and I saw that the agreement that we signed with a Chinese company to operate that port was actually a pretty comprehensive and good agreement that gave us all the tools from the security point of view to make sure that our national security interests are not undermined. To the extent that we share that information with the United States, because in the U.S. ports, you had a situation in which there, for example, were Chinese cranes that are the best cranes in the world, these automatic cranes that are being used everywhere in any modern port. And those over there weren't regulated at all. So we actually offered cooperation with the United States to deal with such threats. One of the concerns, for example, were cyber threats that are coming from a maritime activity. And we, you know, we formed a joint group to deal with those. When it comes to infrastructure, we have taken the necessary measure to make sure that when tenders are being written, national security interests of Israel are being included in those in the parameters of the tenders. Because in the past, this was just to be a kind of the job of the finance ministry without involving any other security establishment entities. And there was a fear that if the, you know, security establishment, you know, sort of imposes its opinion in a let's say unmeditated way, this can undermine the economic interests of Israel. So this was done after a very long debate in Israel. Unfortunately, I think this is working pretty well now. The other concern that you were mentioning is the technology issue that the in the private sector, and that actually was pretty easy to sort out because, as you know better than me, 80% of foreign investment to Israel, to the high-tech sector, is coming from the United States. So no company in Israel that wants to continue working with the United States would actually do anything that would undermine that. And therefore, you could clearly see in the years between 2018 to now that the level of foreign investment coming from China to Israel in the high-tech sector has significantly decreased. And this is not something that has to do with government policy, but by the policy of the companies that have had an interest to continue working with the United States.
Thank you. Well, this has been a really a fascinating and in-depth and serious discussion about the future of the region and even of East-West relations, specifically for us from the economic perspective, which is crucial for the strategic and the security and the diplomatic elements, but often gets overlooked. I have a last question. We've talked at what India is looking for from Israel. What can Israel or Israelis learn from India?
Well, this is becoming not only an important, but a crucial relationship for Israel. First of all, we've seen in the last 20 months that, you know, whatever we had to have with India in terms of changes of supply have continued during the last 20 months, and we haven't seen any disturbance in our trade with India in any field. The second is that as much as the India market is growing, you're going to have many more opportunities, not only for trade, but also for mutual investment. I'm going to participate when I at the end of the month in a ceremony of a new Indian investment in Israel of several dozens of millions of dollars. As I told you before, Israel is the biggest innovation hub outside the United States, and there are many companies in India, very big companies, multi-billion dollars, sometimes even more, that are coming to Israel to scout for technologies. So we are trying to encourage that. It's becoming very important because we want Indian companies to invest in Israel. This hasn't been happening in the past because India was too concentrated in investing only inside India. But now, as a result of what I told you about before, global competition, different levels of technology are required. There is huge potential for us in addition to the things we've been doing in agriculture. We want to do that in the field of water too. Israel, unlike agriculture, that we are probably 10th in the world. In water, Israel is number one in the world. And India is going to invest tens of billions of dollars in the coming years to clean up their entire water systems that have been contaminated as a result of the development. So this is a huge potential for us. We are working, we are sending delegations. By the way, this year we're going to send to Israel 25 Indian delegations just in the context of our public diplomacy effort, a new effort that is championed by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs with new money that has been coming in from the Treasury. And we are, you know, focusing on the things that have the greatest potential, like technology, like water. There is a new field that I'm trying to promote now. It's the agrovoltaic field. You know, India has been very successful in switching into renewables. They've been, ramping up their solar energy production from 4 giga to 100 giga in 10 years. And they want to get to 300 giga until 2030. And this is creating a challenge because you're going to have in the coming years a competition on land between agriculture and energy use. But the agrovoltaic can combine the two. And there are several companies in Israel, companies like Enlight and Doral, that are actually developing technologies to grow more than 40 crops in fields that you can use both for agriculture and for solar energy production. That has a huge potential, of course, for Israel, but also for India and for the rest of the world. We are now looking at cooperation between universities, because the presidents of universities in Israel actually are discovering Indian Academy. And we've been hosting in the last few months presidents of universities coming from Israel that are, you know, getting into agreements with private universities in India and with the IITs. These are the kind of Technion, the MITs of India. And they're doing very good cooperation. The idea is not only to exchange students and to do R&D together, but also to connect between the TTOs, the transfer of technology offices of the universities, of the public hospitals in Israel, with partners in India. And that takes us to the next level, because not only that, now we are producing together, especially in the defense field, we can do R&D together. And we have a small R&D fund that already spent about $25 million. We want to expand that. And the greatest challenge that we have is to bring the big Israeli high-tech companies to India. And then we have some gaps, because there are two things we have to put in order. First is to get a better environment when it comes to agreements. We are negotiating a mutual investment agreement between India and Israel that is in a pretty advanced situation. We want to sign also a trade deal, and that is challenging because India's attention now, of course, is going to the United States, to Britain, to the European Union. We want to get there as well to pave the way for the Israeli companies to more easily do business inside India. The second challenge has to do with the level of ripeness of technology. Usually, Israelis invest in core technology, and in a very early stage, they go out to get money from abroad to develop the technology and to do commercial applications. The Indian market is a market that is more concentrated on solutions that you can scale up. So the technology is ripe for the market. And here, there's a gap that we've identified. We're trying to narrow to encourage more Israeli high-tech companies to come and actually partner with local partners in India and start scaling up the technologies, because it has a huge potential. Many companies in Israel, many startups that are changing their mentality from just doing exit to actually build global companies, and India has a potential for that.
Sounds like there's huge potential for the relations to improve and for the business to grow. So we want to thank you so much, Ambassador Azhar, for coming onto our podcast this week, and hope to continue to hear good news coming out of India from you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Make sure to subscribe so that you get next week's episode right as it comes out. And follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. We're on all the major platforms, Apple, Spotify, YouTube, etc., to keep up to date with us. And as always, you can reach out to us with questions, comments, sponsorship offers at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And we will see you next week.